body heals.
I rebelled, by the way, and I still haven't watched Going to America.
I think this warrants further punishment.
No, it doesn't, because have you watched a movie on Tubi in solidarity?
Well, look, you're the main offender here, not me.
Well, no, because I'm not an offender anymore, because I found the recording and it has been posted up.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like our Russian bots aren't going to feel the same way, but let's see how we go. If anybody actually bothered to engage with us, I'd recommend a poll.
All right, then. What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to Armchair Producers, episode 52 officially, although 53 because we found the missing one from 51, which is now released. I am one of your confusing hosts, George Terran, alongside the man, the myth, the NASA astronaut, Mr. Travis Croft. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine and dandy. I imagine an episode, we have episode 52A then. Does that make sense?
Well, we had 51 and then 51.5. So I think that makes sense. Oh, the video froze and then Travis vanished. Ladies and gentlemen, I am now talking to myself again.
Sorry, we're having some technology issues with the television at my end. Decided to switch yourself back on after being switched off.
Shout out to our Russian bots taking over everything.
Is it? I came back from my holiday and found that my remote worked for one day and then stopped. So handily, I found you can actually download an app, which if it's connected to the same Wi-Fi network as your television, you can use your phone as your TV remote.
That'd be quite a fun way to freak someone out.
Yeah, I had someone come over on Saturday night and they were like, what the fuck are you doing? I'm just like, it's actually quite annoying using your phone as a TV remote. It's not particularly well suited for the job. But it conveniently, before we started recording, decided, no, I think I can now this time in 5 days. So I had to quickly get up and make sure we aren't interrupted by Holiday or whatever TV show is on at the moment here in Australia. So, but it is good to be back in Australia, the land without high fructose corn syrup.
That is true. Have you come down from the inadvertent sugar high that you've had? That is the United States of America.
Trust me, my stomach is thanking me for being back in the country. Does American food, for some reason, really does numbers on my stomach these days. And so Donald, if you're listening, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. there's something about American food after a couple of days. I'm like, seriously, I left the airport. Friend of the show, Patria, and I were at the airport, and the only place to eat in San Francisco airport there was a burger place.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I really, really over burgers. I never thought I was saying that, but I was. on the upside, the burger place at the airport sells excellent craft beer. I feel like that old Monty Python gag, you know, American beer is like having sex in a canoe. It's fucking close to water. Is fast becoming a misnomer. There, at least in Northern California, I will pay this to my friends in Northern California, there is an incredible craft beer scene brewing up there. No pun intended. And there's some, like, I think I had some of the best beer I've ever drank in Northern California. So, and just to show, there's a beer you can get, which apparently is very popular with the locals, called Pliny the Elder. And you can get it at the airport. Pliny the Elder, or Pliny the Elder. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it.
Pliny the Elder is actually from Roman times.
Yeah, it's like a Roman author and philosopher. Yeah. I remember when I used to play Civilization 2, you know, but Pliny the Elder.
Yeah.
You recognize your civilization as being awesome or something, you know, like, yeah, I wonder how many locals get that connection. But that's the name of a beer. It's called Pliny the Elder, and apparently it's very popular, and people line up to get it, and they sell out their releases, like, in a couple of days, every few months when they release a new beer. But it's on tap at this this burger place at San Francisco Airport. So it's a very good IPA, and it's about 7%. If you're our, I'd love to bring you, sort of love to have brought you some back, but transporting beer, not sure about that. And you can't get it in Australia.
I'm disappointed.
The people at the brewery tried, and I went to several breweries while I was there, and one of them at least tried to sell me beer to go. And I was like, dude, I get like 2 liters back into the country. I ain't going to waste it on beer.
But you didn't know that until you tasted Pliny the Elder.
Well, and friend of a show, Patricia, actually helped me get 3 liters back into the country. So yay for traveling with non-drinkers.
Yay! But now, the primary reason you went to the States was for music festival, right?
It was. The Aftershock Music Festival, not one of the world's most famous festivals. I'd never heard of it before, I think, the last 6 months when I bought tickets. Apparently, it's been running since 2013. It was a three-day music festival in Sacramento, California, headlined by, amongst others, Tool, Korn, Rob Zombie, Marilyn Manson, Slipknot, Stained, Blink-182.
Some big names there.
Lamb of God, you get the drift. Baby Metal were there, but they're on in the middle of the afternoon. Hailstorm, Dropkick Murphys, Bad Religion, Sum 41. I'm not saying I saw all these bands. I saw,
Sum 41. That's.
Yes,
they're still together, is one thing that I'm impressed about.
I believe they went on, either broke up or went on hiatus when the lead singer developed a substance abuse problem. But everyone's got bills to pay, and he's paying them. they were on, there were three stages. They were on the smallest one. On, I feel like it was the second evening. And I know, again, I went with a friend of a show, Patria. We were sitting at a picnic table because it was in this big park.
Yeah.
And everyone was smoking weed because it's legal there now, right? So,
of course, yeah.
It's a whole place, all of California stinks like weed now. festival. And I'm like, and then sort of his band came on. I'm like, who's this? And they get the app up. I'm like, that's Sum 41. And you know what? They sounded okay.
So just like when they first popped up onto the scene.
Pretty much. I mean, if you expect any more than okay from Sum 41, you're on a hard to nothing, I think. I'm not a fan. They played a couple of songs I knew, and I'm like, yeah, they sound fine. And then Blink-182 came on later, and they were terrible, which, again, just goes to reinforce they're one of the worst live bands I've ever seen. I'm not a Blink-182 fan, so I'd like to apologize to Blink fans everywhere. I just think they've got their four songs that everybody knows, and the rest of it's pretty shit ass.
Yeah, that's kind of accurate, I think. I mean, I remember college loosely, them knocking around the same time as Sum 41 and Bare Naked Ladies as well. They're all around the same kind of time period.
Sort of like late 90s, 97, 98. I think my housemate had Enema of a State or something back then. And not to focus on the lowlights. They headlined, every crowd seemed into it. Marilyn Manson was fucking wasted at the start of his set.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Wasted, slurring his words, staggering around the stage, and he was suitably pathetic. And I was a big Manson fan back in the day. I would still say Antichrist Superstar and Mechanical Animals, two of my favorite albums.
Yeah.
And I think I saw him play back then, and it almost felt dangerous.
Yeah.
Like dangerous. And that's what you, I think you're kind of what you want when you're playing is kind of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And looking kind of overweight and drunk at the start of your set and slurring your head, do you want to hear the song or not?
Wow.
And they're like, oh, mate, I used to like you so much. I used to like your band so much, but wow.
I feel like I've had a few people kind of go to like group gigs where he's been, like this Aftershock, loads of people, and just all of them saying, yeah, he's clearly not in a good place, because every time he's either doped out of his mind on something or drunk as a skunk and unable to actually even stand. And it's like, okay,
it's really depressing. He's You're right. He's exactly right. He's not in a good place. I mean, it can turn around. I remember a few years ago, I saw Korn, and I remember thinking the same thing, that Jonathan Davis looked overweight and unhealthy and not into what he was doing. But then I think probably at Soundwave, which is a festival here in Australia, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, I saw him. He was great. And then I saw him again last week, and they were fucking great again.
Okay.
But when you juxtapose, say, Manson was on, and then I think an hour or two later, Rob Zombie was on the same stage. Rob Zombie fucking kills.
Yeah.
He just kills. Like, he's a fucking pro. So, you know, that's the difference between him and Manson, because they actually toured together last year. And Manson is not in a good place, but Rob Zombie is a stone cold pro. And that's kind of what you want for your money. But it was fun. It was tiring. It was an interesting festival because weed is legal there. People are smoking it all day.
Yeah.
And it's a really different vibe to a festival in Australia, because we're in Australia, if you go to a hot festival on a summer's day, people are going to be drinking beer all day.
Yeah.
Or alcohol all day. And if a crowd has been drinking alcohol for 8 hours and a crowd has been smoking weed for 8 hours, completely different characteristics to it. So, in a good way, I would say, I think Soundwave had a much better vibe than did any festival I've been to in Australia.
You mean Aftershock or Soundwave?
It's Aftershock.
Okay.
So Aftershock, the festival I just went to, because he says a more mellow vibe. I felt like there were no aggro roid heads running around with flag capes looking to start fights to impress their girlfriends. You know,
the Aussie way.
The Aussie way. So, it was also smaller, I think, though.
Okay.
Comparing, I think it was about 30,000 each day for Aftershock, whereas I think a big day out or a Soundwave, you're probably talking 40 to 50,000 there.
Okay.
And longer day. Anything I will say is that the Americans really need to get with the program. Have they heard of public transport, do you think?
Oh, they heard of it back in 1962, I think it was. And then they thought, nah, we'll have flying cars before too long, so we won't bother investing in it.
And jetpacks. But so there was a bus. There's a $15 you can catch a shuttle to nowhere where you can park your car. And that was it. That was the public transport. It was a one shuttle bus that you could pay to be on. Other than that, it was down to getting a lift or ride sharing. And every night you should it was about, from my friend's house I was staying, it was about $16 to the festival under normal circumstances. With surge pricing, they were charging $80.
Oh, holy shit.
Yeah. So I'd like to shout out to Amber and Ricardo, who gave me a ride the first two nights home.
Yep.
We did catch a lift, or which is the same thing as Uber, on the way home last night, but I managed to scam a deal for $35. So,
hey, not bad, considering.
Talk about chaos trying to get out of that fucking place. I'd also like to give a shout out to Amber and Ricardo for after they picked us up on a Saturday night, took us to a dive bar called Ernie's Interlude. Google it, it's a thing. And they have Saturday night karaoke. And Amber and Ricardo serenaded the bar with, I think, possibly the worst version of Don't You Want Me by the Human League I've ever heard in my life.
Oh,
fortunately, I caught it on video.
Fantastic.
Or most of it anyway. But then, in fairness, a friend of the show, Petrie, and I did decide to step up on behalf of Australia afterwards. And we decided very poorly, because I was a bit drunk, to do a song that was way too fast and I hadn't heard in a few years. So my performance of White Noise by The Living End was a bit sketchy.
Okay.
The choice of Australian songs was a bit limited in California, I'll be playing. So, yeah. I did make a formal apology on behalf of the nation of Australia to Dive Bar. You're not, Australians who are listening, you're not being held responsible, okay? But I feel a real pressing need to go back, because I was looking at Down Under by Men at Work, and I'm like, surely that would have been a better choice. Surely.
Oh, yeah, that would have been good. Oh, well. Maybe you could do a Zoom karaoke.
I'll zoom in. I'm not sure it'll work. But anyway, so shout out to everyone in Northern California who are very nice to me, and especially all the Uber drivers, or most of them anyway. And I did get to watch it on the outside. I did finally switch on my Switch. And on the way home, I booted up Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Okay. Step one.
And all the games I played this year, that is by far the most recent.
Nice.
It looks amazing. How beautifully animated is that game? Mm-hmm. Like, it's the most, like, the animation is probably the most gorgeous animation I've ever seen in a game on any platform ever. So I'll pay that. I felt the sound was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I had my headphones on, my good headphones.
Yep.
And you see that wind, just the wind effects. And I was like, wow, that's nice, wind effects. And I don't notice wind effects very often. props to Zelda for the wind effects. The graphics are incredible. I can see how somebody would fall deeply in love with that game just because it's so charmingly, looks amazing. Has probably more of a focus on puzzles than I like in a game, but I know that's kind of what Zelda is. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's all about its puzzles.
Yeah.
Not that they're like, I mean, because I was on a plane. Normally what happens when I play Skyrim and there are puzzles, I just Google what the answer is because I can't be asked figuring it out. I hate puzzles. But Skyrim's level of puzzles is probably what I'm comfortable with, where it's Zelda's a bit more, but like nothing I couldn't figure out, I don't think. But yeah, I've probably spent 5 hours in game, and I, you know, it's probably what, 5%.
if you're lucky.
hand up and go, I don't sleep on planes. And I was jet lagged while I was in California, so I didn't sleep particularly well the night before. Plane flight. So I was a little bit sleep deprived on the plane, and you know, I was determined to give that game a run. I'm like, when am I going to play it otherwise? and you know, I was probably a little bit tired and a little bit, you know, exhausted. So that's probably not exactly the best mindset to be taking the game on. But the only thing that really annoyed me about it was how often your fucking weapons break. God damn it.
that's been one of the contentions, weapon breakage. I get why they do it. It is frustrating. I wish that it was literally just an option kind of thing where you can kind of go weapon breakage, yes or no. And you can just choose nice and simple, because none of the weapons, especially when you're on the first plateau, the Great Plateau, none of them, unless you're really good at being able to find one of the hidden chests or something like that, you're not going to suddenly be ridiculously OP. And anyway, it's fun to run around and be OP. So I don't think it would break the game to have unbreakable
Does
weapons.
Does it get better though?
Huh?
Do the better quality weapons last longer?
Yes. So they have increased durability or just attack power and things like that. It's not brilliant at communicating what is better at what. You do kind of end up learning some of the symbols and going, oh, okay, that one's better than this one, or that one's kind of good. When you get the Master Sword, which you can get relatively early, at least at its initial stage, that's the one sword where you can just keep using it as a sword, but it has like two phases, one where it's got extra ability that wears down, but it regenerates. It doesn't break, whereas everything else does.
I found it a bit insulting at one point in the game. They're like, oh, don't use your weapon, use your special abilities to drop rocks on monsters. I'm like, oh, sorry, no, that's, you give me way too much credit right now. I'm not going to be fast enough to do that.
It's really fun, like, though.
This is like hard work. I did get off the plateau, though. I did manage to get that far along.
Cool.
I liked that. Maybe I have a feeling maybe it gets better later in the game, but I like that there seemed to be some reward for exploration. I didn't feel a great deal of reward, but there was some reward. But I mean, probably not again. I'm thinking in one of my favorite games, Skyrim, where the reward for exploration is amazing, right? You never fast travel, you walk, because cool shit's going to happen to you on the way. It wasn't quite that, but I feel like I'm very early in the game, and that would probably, again, get better with time. But the I like that there seem to be certain situations, different ways of approaching a situation. Like I came across what I think was a guardian.
Oh, yeah.
A big rock thing. It shot lasers at me and killed one shot me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, my arrows are barely scratching this thing.
Yeah.
How am I going to kill this? And I'm like, oh, actually, you know what? I can just walk around it, right? I don't actually need to kill this thing. I'm like, I like that. It's like really frustrates me when games go, ha-ha, here's a mini-boss and it's really challenging.
Yeah.
And, you know, really fucking, they just like amps the difficulty level up to 11. And you can't get past it. And you get really frustrated at points like that. And I'm like, I don't want to sit here for hours trying to beat this fucking thing.
Yeah.
I'll just quit and do something else I enjoy.
Yeah.
And I like that this game actually offered you a chance to go, yeah, you could. I mean, I could probably, if I was clever, have sat behind a rock and shot, you know, and arrowed it and probably knocked it down in about half an hour and used all my ammo or something. But, like, I didn't need to. You can go around it. I'll come back to it later if I need to.
There's the two things I think with it is, first up, the Great Plateau is essentially the kind of tutorial area. There's nothing too ridiculously sort of like, oh my God, this is just too powerful, but it's got a taster of everything. Like, oh, you could try using your the Sheikah Slate to stop time and do different things like that. You can use all your weapons. You get the glider and everything pretty quickly. It's sort of like, okay, go do it. The big thing that I find between Breath of the Wild and Skyrim, and I've started playing Witcher 3 on Switch, is the way that they engage the open world. For Breath of the Wild, the whole thing is kind of like one giant puzzle, and it's your way to, how are you going to work around it? Are you going to take on the Guardian head on? Are you going to move around them? Are you going to do different things? And it's just one big puzzle leading to other puzzles. Whereas the Witcher and Skyrim, it's this huge open world, which is beautiful, and there's so much stuff that can happen, but traveling from one area to another isn't rewarding. You do that because you're suddenly going to see something else in the distance that's like, oh, I'm going to just suddenly start taking on this griffin, or I'm going to have a fight with a dragon over here. And there's just these moments that you can wander into. Whereas moving around the Breath of the Wild world is part of the puzzle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, one of my favorite things about Skyrim is when you're walking down the road, and there was a bit of a meme, right? Three guys jump out and you go, hey, look, it's the Dragonborn. Let's mug him.
I seem to always get that one guy just runs up to you and it's like, oh, it's another messenger, and they're like, no, it's an assassin. Why? I don't know why.
I mean, you get to that point in the game and people are trying to kill you all the time. I kind of like that about the game. But look, I can definitely see, like, I was a bit worried about it would be like my experience with BioShock, which I've talked about before, where I found that really boring. Assassin's Creed, which I found really boring, or even a game like, say, Spider-Man on the PlayStation, which I'm not saying is boring. It's just that I just can't get used to a PlayStation controller after using an Xbox controller for so long. Xbox button's in the wrong place. I didn't find any of that with Zelda. I mean, I said I found the look of the game really charming. The lack of voice acting in parts is a little bit annoying, but like, overall, I could definitely see. And the fact that the challenges, the puzzles were good enough that, in a sense, that I could feel like I had to think a little bit, but I figured, I always felt like I could figure it out if I just, you know, just try this, you know, you get there. And that's what I enjoyed about Skyrim was, like, not so much with puzzles, but with battles in Skyrim, like, I just think there's so many different ways I can approach this.
Yeah.
I just need to keep trying, and I will find a way I can beat this.
Yeah.
With Zelda, I feel like, not so much in the battle, but I'm sure that comes later, but these puzzles, I just need to keep trying, and I will be able to figure out how to get past this, because there are a finite way. There's a way through this.
Yeah.
And I don't need to be reading the manual to get it. So I'm not sure when I'll have a chance to sit down with it again, because The Outer Worlds comes out tomorrow.
And apparently it's really good.
And it comes with my Xbox Game Pass.
Oh, yeah, because they're now part of Microsoft. That's right, yeah. So
I don't even have to pay extra for it because I already subscribed to Game Pass. So, I mean, that's going to be good value. I haven't even finished Borderlands 3 yet. but I will. I like the fact, though, that Zelda, I know, is super high quality, super charming, and it's just going to be sitting there waiting for me when I have the time to sit down with my Switch again. And I will say, I didn't get to use it a lot on my trip. Really good traveling toy, the Switch. I'm really glad I took it. I took my iPad and my Switch. I really wish I hadn't taken my iPad because it sat there and took up space and did nothing that my phone couldn't do. But Switch, like the I flew on the 787 with Qantas, who are an excellent airline. Sponsor us, please. we'll podcast for free flights.
we'll podcast on the flight.
Gladly. I'm sure it'll be very entertaining for the other passengers. and there were noise. It'd be great. But I are quieter than the A380s. But the 787, which is the Qantas flight that flies to San Francisco, Qantas do an amazing job. For under $1,000, I got a really great experience on the plane. So, I mean, compared to, say, JetScum, fuck Jetstar. Qantas are amazing. And the plane itself is really good. They've got a little... They've got the tray table for your meal,
yeah.
But the seat has a tray table about another third of a way up the chair.
Okay.
You can flip down and you can put your phone, your tablet, your Switch into that little tray. Oh. And it's got a USB port in the side of the actual little thing, pop-out bit. So,
nice.
You know, the Breath of the Wild really sucks that battery down. Mm. So you just whack your cable, USB cable in there and you could play for as long as you want. But it's right at your, just about right at your eye level until they flip the person in front reclines. So it's a really good, it's the 787 for those of you who haven't had a chance to fly it yet. If you're feeling like, oh, is it worth taking my Switch on the plane? I feel like it's, if you're a fan of the Switch, it's a good way to kill some time on the flight. Despite the fact the in-flight entertainment is also excellent, but if you're looking for something a bit different, there is no games anymore. Remember they used to have games sometimes on the planes that have like a...
I was never on a plane when there was were games. Remember, I was all of the flights that I ever took, aside from going to America, to Canada, and to Australia, everything was fucking Ryanair. And it's like, oh yeah, get out and push. That's first class.
No, I wouldn't expect games on a domestic flight, but I've been on a few international flights where you used to pop out the remote control from your seat and you could hold it sideways and it'd be like a shitty, really shitty Mario knockoff or or Patience or something, solitaire you could play. Anyway, you could play in A380, I think you can actually play chess and stuff against other people in the plane. Don't quote me on that. They're usually really lousy games, but I think
you've
sort of gone to the 787. They're no good. Why bother trying?
All right. Nice.
So that's a thumbs up, by the way, in case people are confused. That is definite thumbs up for Breath of the Wild, for a non-Nintendo man, for a non-puzzle fan. It's good.
There we go. There we go.
Zelda is good.
Like I said before, I'm playing Witcher 3 on Switch, and it's really impressive, the fact that it's the full game. Comparing it to the Xbox and PlayStation, and I think it was on PC, comparing it to that is like, oh, this looks like shit. But when you're just playing it on the Switch, you've got everything there. It's all voice acted. It runs really nice. There's a couple of areas where it kind of hitches in the frame rate a little bit, but it's not to true detriment. I'm not a big fan of the control scheme of it, but that was something I also felt when I played it on Xbox. I just found that it was kind of a bit too much like old school Assassin's Creed, where it's like, oh, you're in the middle of an animation and it has to go through the whole thing. You can't kind of fluidly move around and like Dark Souls, Demon Souls, even Breath of the Wild's combat was just better and more intuitive on the go. But it's fine. It's not an issue of the Switch version or anything like that. It's really good. And the fact that I can just play it at work, I can play it anywhere, means that I've sunk, I think, 20 hours into it. And I've barely done any of the main story. I'm just going off and just hunting creatures and all sorts of stuff. And it's fun and it's good and it looks good. It looks good enough is the big thing.
I really felt like I should like it because it's the kind of game I should like.
Mm.
But I downloaded it on PC and I just couldn't get into it. Mm. For some reason, it just wasn't for me. But maybe it will be different on Switch. I don't know. But again, it's the kind of game that's going to need a significant time investment.
Oh, God, yeah. 100%. And I can already feel myself this time next week, I'll be playing Luigi's Mansion 3. And I probably will do what I did with Pillars of Eternity and Xenoblade Chronicles 2 and all the other big RPGs. I'll get about a 20-30 hour mark into them and something new will come along that's much easier. Pick up and play and just have silly fun, not have to think about it or invest in, oh shit, yeah, what happened last time? Yeah, but on that note, actually, Witcher 3 is really good. When you boot up, it kind of does almost like a previously on kind of thing where it catches you up on the story that you've developed so far. So it's like, oh, okay.
Last week on Family Ties.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. So like last week on The Witcher, you killed things and you are actually on the route to this. It's like kind of, oh yeah, remember, this is the main storyline and you are supposed to be doing that. You're not, but I'm just reminding you that it's there. If you actually want to complete the game, you're going to eventually have to go there. But it's no judgment. It's fine, you know. but yeah, it's entertaining, and I'm really looking forward to Luigi's Mansion 3 because I really love the other two. They're just so much fun and stupid and silly.
I think I played Luigi's Mansion in an arcade in Japan a few years ago.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It was fun. It had like a vacuum cleaner as the control.
That's it. Yep. That's it. It's just silly, brilliant Luigi dumbness, and I love it. I was going to play it at PAX, which I went to, and I realized, not a conventions, man. Not a conventions.
It's the first PAX you've been to, right?
Yeah, it's the first PAX I've been to.
I went to PAX last year, and I didn't enjoy it. What was your takeaway?
It's definitely not something that is designed for someone like me, where I want to just experience and kind of get over it. Whereas I went there kind of thinking, oh, PAX, it's for tabletop gaming is the primary thing. It felt like there was a teeny tiny section of it. Is when I entered in, there was just huge fucking display for a new update to Rage 2 on these big screens. And it was super loud. It was like walking into a gaming-centric rave. And it's like, okay, this is an experience. And you kind of walk through, and then it was just the big video game companies. There was Xbox, there was Nintendo, there was PlayStation. They had big Squaresoft, Ubisoft, and all these things. Huge displays, pumping the music out so loud. Phenomenally big queues everywhere. And it's like, okay, I'm not engaging with that right now. I want to just find a D&D table, sit down and play some D&D. And I worked my way through probably 2/3 of the whole convention area, got to the tabletop area, and it was like, oh, there's not actually much here to do beyond really shopping. I think there may have been like 20 tables laid out to sit down and play that were being kind of guided. And they were all full. So it's kind of, oh. Well, that's annoying. And there were plenty of blank tables everywhere so that you could, if you got together a group of people, you could play, but no one was really doing that. And it's like, okay, well, this is disappointing. It was just like when we went to Comic-Con a couple of years ago. It's like, okay, I feel like I've just paid $70 to come into this place to queue up.
To shop.
And it's not as if there was anything extra special that I was getting at these places. It was literally just transplanted versions of these stores. I'm like, okay. I played The Witcher 3 there before I got it on Switch at home. And There were four units set up playing Witcher 3 in this kind of cordoned off area. But it was right in the heart of gaming territory. And the music and the noise was so much. I just pulled out my headphones and just went, hey, any chance I can just plug this in so I can hear what's going on? And one of the guys went, yeah, that's fine. And just as I was about to plug in, another guy went, not company policy, can't do that. I'm like, okay, can I ask why?
Hear the game and trying to convince you it's worth buying.
Yeah, I asked why, and he said, oh, we don't want you recording. I'm like, it's headphones.
It's The Witcher 3. It came out fucking years ago.
And there was no one else playing. There was me and three empty ones. It's like, oh, come on. But fine, company policy, they're just following company policy. That's whatever. Okay, you know what? Fine. I thought, well, maybe I'll try Luigi's Mansion 3. And this was about 11 o'clock in the morning, and they had already stopped the line. And there was a guy at the end just holding up a sign saying, we've stopped the line for now. There's over a 2-hour wait. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to wait 2 hours, even at the best of times, just to play 5 minutes of a game. Fuck that. No, it's not worth it. So these kinds of places are for, they'd be great if you're young, you've got plenty of time to just sit around and do nothing, and you have a group of people with you who are in exactly the same mindset of, oh yeah, really excited to just get a taste of this game, and we're just going to talk about it. The cosplay was awesome. If you are fully invested in just, people don't go for one day. I think that if you were going for 3 days, maybe the 2-hour queue waiting for a mass release game might be more palatable, but it just seemed very, very corporate, and it just
wasn't. It is. I mean, it costs a fortune to go.
Oh, God, yeah. But there is ArcanaCon coming in January, which is just strictly tabletop gaming. And so I'm going to go to that and see if that's more my kind of thing, because
real bag.
Yeah, because obviously PAX didn't really float my boat. Its focus was very much not what I had been kind of led to believe, of more of the old school comics and tabletop kind of gaming. It was really nice to see, though, as soon the main entrance, when you walk in, huge display promoting independent game producers from Melbourne and Australia. So that was really good. It was real front and center stuff. So it's good to see them really backing that.
One thing I say about for me that I did enjoy about PAX last year was all the talks and the seminars and stuff, which are over in the plenary building. I went to about three or four of those, and I really enjoyed them. Went to one that was hosted by a guy who hosts a YouTube game review channel called Skill Up. Does fantastic long form game reviews, and I'd never heard of him before, but hearing him talk at PAX last year, I'm a subscriber to his channel now. So that was half a reason, part of the fact that I was out of the country. one of the main reasons I had absolutely zero intention of going back this year was the fact that you're paying, I can't remember what I paid last year, it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
$160 maybe to get a 3-day ticket. I remember wandering around and last year that what you were smacked in the face with when you walked in was 476. That worked out well. That was everywhere. That was the big game of last year. And I'm walking into that massive room of, you know, as you sort of said, every major computing or gaming company on the planet was in massive stalls, and people shouting with microphones and come up and play a pro in Fortnite and yada yada. And you're like,
yeah,
you know, and I didn't even have that tabletop gaming thing to actually look forward to, because not really my bag, but I just remember wandering through there going, what the fuck did I actually pay for? And I remember just spending probably most of the day in talks over in the plenary, because they were genuinely interesting. But I wasn't going to pay anything like that kind of money to go back again this year just to sit in conference rooms and listen to people talk, as interesting as they may be. But as you sort of say, if you're into one or more elements of it, like I dated someone for a while who went last year and did a cosplay. She went this year and did an amazing World of Warcraft cosplay I saw on Facebook. That's a good reason to go, I guess.
Yeah.
Or if you know somebody like that who is going and you want to help them out or whatever, but yeah, it's, you're right. It's for a certain audience, and I'm not it.
Yeah, I just found that it was kind of like I was looking at all the talks, and none of them really kind of struck me as like, oh, you know what? Yeah, that sounds interesting. I'll go and check that out. I'm sure they were awesome, but they just weren't for me. It just wasn't a thing for me. That was a shame. So I left after about 3.5 hours or so. And I decided, you know what? This is a perfect opportunity for me to go and watch Joker.
What did you make of it?
Really loved it. There is, aside from Joaquin Phoenix's performance as Joker, there is not really anything that is going on in this movie that is revolutionary or phenomenal. It borrows so liberally from very clearly Scorsese's work as well.
The first thing I got when I saw this was like, wow, somebody's got a fucking massive hard on for Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
I heard a lot of people say King of Comedy. Honestly, that's a film I've never seen, but the Taxi Driver is a film I've seen endlessly.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites, but I'm like, my God, he's just whole parts of it almost felt lifted from
the color palette, the close-up shots, the real intimacy. It's so Taxi Driver. But that's not a bad thing. It riffs on that well, and it works well for the story they're trying to tell with Joker. Joaquin Phoenix's performance was wonderful. I really loved it. So I don't think there's any in any world where you can kind of go, oh, this is one of the best movies ever, because it's not really doing anything innovative other than telling a good story of a villain in a compelling way. I think
you can say this is one of the more original comic book films made in recent times.
I would say that's kind of fair. In many ways, like we've talked about it in the past with the Marvel movies, kind of them hijacking different genres and just happen to put a superhero in it. Like, oh, buddy cops in space, Thor and Hulk, and that sort of stuff. This is kind of, oh, you know what? Taxi Driver with a Batman villain.
Exactly. Instead of Travis Bickle,
yeah,
it's a joke.
Yeah, and I feel like you could do some interesting stuff, like doing a retelling of Seven with superheroes and supervillain. That'd be kind of cool. And
isn't there like a famous serial killer in the Batman universe, ZYXX?
I can't remember.
In the Batman games, anyway, he's like a serial killer kind of guy.
Yeah, but if DC were kind of going, all right, they've got more of the pulpy pop culture kind of thing going on in Marvel, and it fits their characters. Cool. We're going to do kind of adult, mature movie variations.
It's exactly what they were trying to do with the Snyderverse, but they just chose the wrong director, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's kind of been, I feel like that's been, they've identified that a while ago as a space they can play in.
Yeah.
Apart from Aquaman and Wonder Woman, which don't really fit, but that were the Force Awakens of the DC universe. That was the apology to the fan base going, sorry, we kind of fucked that up. Here's some fluff.
Yeah.
But everything is back on track. Is you've been calling for this kind of thing for quite some time for standalone pictures. No, I saw it at the Astor about 2 or 3 days before I left to go overseas. And I was the same in the sense that I remember walking out of a theater going, did I actually enjoy that? Or do I like that or do I hate that? Do I like that or hate it? And the last time I had that reaction to was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I never get that reaction when I go to see a Marvel film. Normally I walk out and go, that was fun. Unless it's Captain Marvel, in which case I go, that sucked. you never have any kind of, there's never any kind of thought process that's triggered by what you've just seen. It's never like, you know, going, you know, stop it. You don't think about it the next day. How was Endgame? And you go, oh, it was really fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But you know,
what happened in it? Stuff.
You know, what you would expect to happened in it. You know, yes. Like, you never think about the film independently after the film happens. But I found myself thinking about Joker well into my flight to the States going, This is a good sign. The fact that it's actually triggered me to actually stop and think, consider what I saw and process it and then go, I think I need to see it again.
Yeah.
I think it's, from a comic book perspective, I think it's in the masterpiece category. You're right. It's not in the, if you take it out of the comic book genre and go into the broader all films, it just rips off too much from better films to ever try and place it in a category to, like, you couldn't put it alongside Taxi Driver because Taxi Driver was completely original. No one had done that before.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the world of music, you probably heard me say this before, like, if you're going to rip somebody off, rip off the best.
Yep.
You know, like, remember many, many years ago when Wolfmother first released their album, people were like, oh, but just Led Zeppelin ripoffs. You're like, yes, I can see that. But if you're going to rip somebody off.
Yeah.
Not make it Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You know, anybody ripping off Nickelback, right? Like, if you're ripping off Nickelback, you're doing it wrong. You know, so
every week another knife goes into the back of Nickelback.
Be a show without it. So you know, like, it's you're gonna rip somebody off. Rip off Scorsese, man. Like,
yeah,
go for it. I mean, the guy's DC comic book films, it is. So you might as well give him something to complain about. I've already can make up all the controversy about it.
I think there's a lot of people projecting a lot of opinions onto this movie that aren't really there. There's a lot of suggestion. Todd Phillips is not a nuanced director. He was a competent Foscazy. And I think that a lot of there's obviously some kind of social commentary to a point about it, but I don't think it's actually trying to make a political statement in any way. I think that there was more of a political statement being made in the Dark Knight movies, and it was being more competently told and extrapolated in those movies because Chris Nolan is a better director than Todd Phillips. But I find it interesting that this movie, where I can see why everyone is talking so vehemently in so many different points of view about, oh, it's celebrating mania and celebrating murder. And I'm like, I don't think it actually is, because Joker, he's not doing, he does things just because. He doesn't actually think of cause and effect on anything. And
to quote Heath Ledger, do I really look like a guy with a plan?
Exactly.
I'm a dog chasing cars. Yeah. I wouldn't know what to do with it if I caught one.
Yeah. And
that's the Joker's character.
Yeah, and I think that Joaquin Phoenix plays that perfectly, and I think the story delivers that fine. And if you are putting more onto it, okay, cool. I'm not going to argue with you, because there's no point. It's a movie.
I was surprised, because, like, I didn't think it was a particularly violent film.
There's not
much. Yes, there is violence in there. There are violent acts, and the final act is quite shocking in a really satisfying kind of way, but I think it's R-rated. Is it R-rated?
Yes, because it's on track to become the most successful R-rated superhero movie.
It's R-rated in the States. I think it might be MA 15 plus in Australia.
I think so.
So you shouldn't be taking young children to see it. No. I think Todd Phillips came out and said, don't take your kids to see it. They'll be bored. They won't like it.
Yeah.
But it's not a particularly violent film. I mean, it says something about how pussy films have become these days. If this film is considered ultra violent compared to, say, Reservoir Dogs or Natural Born Killers, or not, remember the fuss about Natural Born Killers? Oh my god. You know, those films from the 90s that were really, really violent. Really,
like, oh, this is truly celebrating murder and mass murder and things like that. It's like, yeah, I can kind of see why they're saying that for those movies. For this one,
not for Joker. I mean, in fairness to Zoe, spoilers, guys, if you haven't seen it, I think we're being fairly spoiler-free today. That might say some shit in the next 5 minutes. It might change that. But what does he kill? He kills the three guys on the train. He kills that asshole from his work. So that's four.
Yep.
And he kills Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Five. In the body count's five.
And the three guys on the train, that was self-defense as well. Well, two of them were self-defense. One of them he then hunted. But it was... You hurt me, and I am going to... This is how I balance the scale now.
So, I mean, a body count of 5 is pretty low. I mean, and I think the murders on the train, one of them is fairly shocking. So there are 2-3 fairly shocking murders in the film. But I feel like they are in context of the film. They are not gratuitous. This is not a character who is just walking up to people in the street and shooting them in the head. Yeah. Everybody dies in this film. There's a reason he's doing what he's doing. Whether it's the demented reason, a misguided reason for his mental illness, you know, you can make up your own mind by seeing the film. But I was just shocked. To be, oh, my God, incels are going to be shooting up theaters. And, you know, like really? I mean, I just was waiting for this violence to happen. I thought it was a character piece.
Yeah.
Punctuated by sharp spikes of violence. Very much again, much like Taxi Driver. Not much happens in that film.
Yeah.
There are really sharp spikes of intense violence in that film.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, did Scorsese put up with this in the 70s? Like, were there assholes in the newspaper going, oh my God, people are going to see Travis Bickle and they're going to take women to porn films and shoot pimps who look like Harvey Keitel? it's like, I don't know. I was just thoroughly, thoroughly confused by when I saw the film. I was like, this is what? What are you getting all up in your panties and a knot for? It's what? I don't get it. It's the fact
that it is causing conversation, I think, is a good sign that it's doing a certain number of things well and doing it right, because you certainly don't have these kinds of points of conversation with much other big budget Hollywood launched movies. It's usually just some form of Tarantino thing that someone comes out with and that sparks debate. And it's usually because, oh, he's being sexist towards women, which obviously he shouldn't do, but it's...
Oh, he's racist now. Did you see he's racist?
Yeah. But it's usually to controversy around a movie is usually to do with sexism and racism. And this sparking violence is interesting, especially when you think of Deadpool. That was celebrated for it. And there is way more gratuitous violence in those movies.
I mean, there's a tone, like you put a laugh track over the violence and people go, that's okay.
Yeah. So it for people who kind of go, oh, I love Deadpool, but Joker went too far. I don't understand their logic of that. So I'm like, okay. I'm so
thoroughly, thoroughly confused about the whole thing. The only thing I could come up with was the whole thing was a studio plot to get more publicity. looking to pushing up to grossing around 900 million now.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
I don't know what it costs to make, but I doubt it was terribly expensive. Apart
not
from
much, game. Not much.
Right, I would have thought it was in the 60 to 70 million range.
Yeah, there are two things that I'd like to talk about with the movie.
You've gone quiet, sir.
Oh, is that better?
And we're back. Okay. That's better. This is the enjoying the Australian internet, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, it's such a wonderful thing.
So you were saying?
Two parts of the movie. First, one thing that I think was a mistake was having the death of the Wayne family shown. I don't think you needed that at all. I think it, you know, just instead of having the iconic moment where the pearls come falling and all of that shit, you could have just very easily had just a little something, maybe a newspaper where it's like the city mourns the death of the Wayne family or something like that. You don't need to.
I was at the same thing. I was a bit cringy because I'm like, how many times have we seen this now?
Every time.
We saw it again with what's his name? The guy from Walking Dead played.
Dawn of Justice. Yeah, they did it again.
Yeah, but what I was thinking the same thing. You probably didn't show. What I thought would have been nice would have been a little Easter egg, like he's catching a cab down the street and just out the window you see a mum, a dad, and a little kid walking out of the theater around the corner or something like that.
Yeah, and maybe something along those lines.
You can, you know, if you pause the film, you go, ah, that's Thomas Wayne.
Yeah. Anything like that would have been better than showing it again. It's one of the reasons why Tom Holland in Spider-Man Homecoming was so good, because they didn't have to waste any time. How does he get his powers? They just went on with it and they had a casual conversation with his best friend saying, oh, it was a spider. It's dead. Move on. Cool. Everyone fucking knows. It doesn't matter anymore. You don't need to see it every time. So I think that was a bit of a fault of the movie. But the one thing that I really liked and that it played very well was the relationship with Zazie Beetz' character. How they played that all out. Because right up until the revelation of that, and I won't go into spoilers exactly about it, the revelation of that, I fully believed it. And then the revelation of what it actually was, it's like, oh fuck, I felt so much pathos for Joker in that point, and it was really well done. I think they really, really deserve praise for that. I think
I'm with you. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it just played perfectly, and it made you really empathize with his character, and it made just you felt it. It was absolute brilliant piece of cinema.
I was the same thing. I was like, oh my god, I did not see that coming at all. And when you get me, you get it. You do well, because I feel like we're pretty cynical, you and I, and you have that innate ability to see, to be constantly thinking in the back of your head, what's the twist? What's the twist? What's the twist? What's the twist? And ruin it for yourself. That's your superpower.
Ruining my own life.
So, you know, like the fact you didn't pick this one, that's props to Todd Phillips. I mean, I really dug it. I really enjoyed Joaquin's portrayal of a man with mental illness. I mean, and some of the lines in here, you know, like the thing about the problem with mental illness is that people constantly expect you to act like you don't have one. And you know, I wonder, maybe that's what's bothering people. People talk about how they like to talk about mental illness, but I wonder, do we really? So, you know, maybe that's what's making people uncomfortable, is the actual somewhat realistic portrayal of somebody with mental illness on the big screen who's not, you know, a drooling lunatic. They're talking about a sequel. By the way, the budget was $55 million.
Damn, which it's done well.
I hope Joaquin's got a back-end deal on this. I hope he's getting points.
Yeah.
I would have thought he would be, I would have gone and seen it again in San Francisco if it wasn't sold out. Here's a little taster for you. On a Wednesday in San Francisco, the 1 o'clock session was sold out last Thursday.
Jesus.
And it'd been out for, 2 or 3 weeks at that point in time in the States. Yeah. And this wasn't like a particular, it's in a cinema in a funny part of town. So, you know, we were a bit surprised. I mean, sure as hell, we were like, we could go and sit outside and talk, or we could see Gemini Man. Let's go and sit by the fountain.
You mentioned one thing that I wanted to talk about as well, going off of moving on from Joker. Gemini Man and the sequel to Maleficent are now out, but is it just me, or did they have no pomp and circumstance ahead of them? They've just like, oh, there's a trailer and they're out. And they seem to have died.
I wasn't here the week they launched.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I didn't see, and I don't watch free-to-air television. So I have a feeling they might have buried Gemini Man because the reviews have been pretty bad. So that's not unusual. I can't say I saw a lot. But then again, like I said, the week they were released here, I was on a plane. Maybe I missed it, but yeah, like there were plenty of tickets to Gemini Man. Let me tell you that Joker may have been sold out, but there were lots of seats still to Gemini Man, and that was the newer film.
The real point that I'm curious about is Maleficent, the first one, did pretty well. Financially, it did quite successful. I mean, the fact that it gets a sequel and Angelina Jolie came back, it says something to the success of the first one. I'm wondering if
this anymore.
Huh?
He doesn't work much anymore.
No, not much. She's next going to be seen, I think, in The Eternals, which is the next phase of MCU. But it makes me wonder, it's all part of the Disney brand of Maleficent. I wonder if there's oversaturation, and Disney have tried to release so many movies this year that they're kind of losing their own films within their own shuffle, because it feels like we had that massive run of The Lion King, Aladdin, Maleficent, and it feels like every month there's been a big Disney movie, and they can't keep the pace that they were trying to keep. And I wonder if this is the first sign of, okay, you know what? A movie every 2 months, or a movie every month, or however frequent it is, maybe we can't do that. Maybe this should have been just left to Disney Plus, like Lady and the Tramp is going to be, and things like that.
Well, maybe it's just a reflection of it. I never saw Maleficent. Mm. Didn't interest me. Maybe this is a film people weren't interested in seeing. Like, it was no
maybe
groundswell of people like, I really want more Maleficent, right?
Right.
Currently, it's grossed $160 million globally. Don't know what the budget is. It's probably not a great result for them.
Mm.
It's, you know, and it's up against, as we can see here, Joker still has some sort of appeal. Just my anecdotal story about going to the movies at 11 o'clock, at 1 o'clock on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And the bad reviews for Gemini Man probably, you know, probably preceded it, and then adopted it in a semi-quiet time of year.
Yeah.
It's not exactly tentpole season.
Yeah.
It's the hit machine of Disney, you know, it's going to have a few flops here and there, but I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure Endgame more than makes up for it.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, Disney have already made more money than God because of the pre-sale tickets in America for the new Star Wars movie.
What did you make of the latest trailer that dropped this week?
I don't care. I really don't care. It looks fine. It looks like very typical J.J. Abrams movie trailer. So like, hey, look at all this cool stuff that's going to make you remember cool stuff from your childhood. And yeah, I don't care. They're
movies for me. So this, just, you know. My reaction was the same, but then again, we had very different reactions to the last Star Wars film. So I think that's where my I don't care comes from, is that I was so deeply disappointed in whatever the last one was called. Whatever it was, the Revenge of a Jedi or whatever it was called. The horse race.
Revenge of Canto Bight.
I was so deeply disappointed and cynical about what they made of it, how they treated their fans with that film. This one, look, I mean, I liked The Force Awakens. I genuinely liked it.
Fine.
And I, in a way, I agreed with the Rian Johnson direction, and I've said it before. Is it like, you know, yes, I was quite happy to go, let's go with a familiar, nostalgic, warm, fuzzy Force Awakens to apologize for the fucking awful prequels.
Mm.
Then let's do something different. They did the wrong something different for me. But then to go flip back to, okay, now we need to go back to warm, fuzzy, remember Regina, did I? I remember. I feel like that was a wrong choice.
You know, the final trailer opens up with her running through a lush green forest. Like, okay, Return of the Jedi. Okay. And it just kind of felt like greatest hits.
Flying the freaking Millennium Falcon again in the trailer. And you're like, yeah, okay. Well, look, I mean, I'm going to say it anyway, but I mean, I didn't like the trailer. I mean, I've seen a lot of memes on Twitter, which I really quite enjoy, going, yeah, Disney executive, how many ships do you want, JJ? JJ, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw quite a good one where she was just analyzing that J.J. Abrams likes to have starships coming out of water. And he does it in Star Trek, he's done it in Star Wars. This movie, I'm going to go and see it, obviously. I'm expecting this to be on the same entertainment level as a Marvel movie, where it's going, oh yeah, that was fine. I'm probably not going to be thinking about this movie half a day after I've watched it. And that's fine. If it entertains me for the time of the movie, that's really, it's done its job, because it's Star Wars. If Star Wars keeps me thinking and contemplating like Joker did, wow.
Wow. Yeah, no, you're right. I'm not looking for a thought-provoking, I'm not looking for a dark, gritty film in the Star Wars universe, at least not for this one, but that would be interesting on Disney Plus. If I can walk away from this one feeling like I did after Force Awakens, was like, yeah, that was fun. Yeah. That was fun. You know, I remember walking away from that one going, I know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
I can see it. I know you're just feeling purely to my nostalgia. And this is, you know, A New Hope, AKA, you know, with cool special effects, right? And new characters. I knew exactly what he was doing. But I think I actually enjoyed it watching it the second time more than I watched it the first time. But I still had fun with it. Yeah. I didn't feel insulted. I didn't, which is what I felt after the Canto Bite film. I didn't feel like this is fucking awful, like I did after the prequels. I didn't feel dirty like I did after the prequels. Like, you know, so yeah, if I don't feel a negative emotion after this film, then that's probably a step up over what's the worst moments of the Star Wars films over the last 20 years have been. But, and I'm not, like I said, I have a friend who, my friend Richard, he says, oh, I really like the trailer. And I felt like saying to him, you have a new Kevin Smith, sir. You have a new Kevin Smith, sir, because you like everything that comes out about Star Wars and everything about that comes out about Batman and everything that comes out about, you know, the Snyderverse. You're like, oh, it's great. I like the trailer. And you're like, sorry, I kind of destroyed your credibility, sir, because all of those films sucked.
I have a friend exactly the same. Shout out to Paul Storm, a friend of the show. I wish that I had his eternal optimism for every movie, because I'll see him post a trailer and it's like, he says, oh, this looks amazing. It's like, I'm glad you can pull that joy. I did not get that emotion out of that. I am envious of the joy that he can get, because there's so few movies that I'm looking at the trailers and going, oh, fuck yeah, I've got to see that in the cinema. And it's like, yeah, I'll watch it when it comes to Netflix.
Yeah, or just a film that doesn't, like, disappoint. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, like, I saw Paul Rudd being interviewed this week on one of the Tonight shows, and he was talking about what little he could say about Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd like to say I'm getting excited about it. Mm. I really, really would. Because, like, I think Jason Reitman's a very fine director, and I like Paul Rudd.
Yep.
And it looks like they've got the original cast back, left of them, playing their original roles, which is a radical idea, I know, right? It's like a Ghostbusters film with the original cast, and they're playing their original characters. I mean, I'm sorry. I've just been burned too many times by reboot, remake, sequel culture. Like, it's just, it could go anyway at this point in time.
If people are getting enjoyment out of these things, that's fine. I'll find my entertainment elsewhere. But honestly, there's not another movie coming out the rest of this year that I am really intrigued by. Joker was the last one, and that succeeded. It did its job. It hit the right buttons for me. It was entertaining as I watched it. It was thought-provoking. It kept with me for a couple of weeks. I was talking with people in the shop about it, and that's the kind of cinema experience that I'm looking for personally. But that doesn't mean to say that I don't enjoy a popcorn movie.
I'm going to recommend a film to you, which I saw. Two films. One to recommend, one to see clear of, which I saw on the plane. And I think when I'm talking about seeing films on the plane, I think people understand that I am talking about the ideal premium cinema experience available to us as human beings. If you have to see a film on the plane, is where you want to be seeing it, right? That's where all the film critics go to see their premieres, so on the plane.
Absolutely.
So the first one, the one to see, if you haven't seen it already, I've been actually kind of keen on seeing it, but it's played so short in Australian cinemas, but yesterday. The Danny Boyle film, Lily James and somebody else I'm not overly familiar with, who I think was actually very good in it. It did star Ed Sheeran as well, which I was a little... Himesh Patel is the actual star of the film. Himesh Patel, who I think is going to be... You can see how he goes. I think he was excellent in this film, but I wonder if there's... I'll be interested to see how he gets cast, as he is of Indian extraction. I don't know if that makes perfect sense in England, but I wonder how it'll go with Americans. Hang on a second. He looks Indian, but he got an English accent. Oh, my God. I'm not saying racist, I promise. It He's wonderful in this film. And this film is directed by Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Of course. Of Trainspotting.
28 Days Later, 127 Hours, Slumdog Millionaire, Shallow Grave.
Academy Award winner.
Yes.
Danny Boyle. Won Best Director, I think, for Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah. And he was going to direct the new Bond movie, but then pulled out.
For creative reasons.
Yep.
So, for those who aren't familiar, yesterday, a struggling musician realizes the only person on Earth who can remember the Beatles after waking up in an alternate timeline where they never existed. This film is also written by Richard Curtis, the man behind, I'm pretty sure he wrote Love Actually, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
I think he had something to do with Mr. Bean, if I'm not mistaken.
Richard Curtis has been involved in most of the well-produced British comedies since the 80s, especially anything that's associated with Rowan Atkinson in some way, shape, or form.
Four Weddings and a Funeral, yep. Love Actually, About Time, as I said, Mr. Bean, The Boat That Rocked, which is one that maybe not a lot of people have seen, but I recommend it. The Vicar of Dibley, Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Frames and Cylinders, Notting Hill, goes on and on. So the guy is a legend of British comedy, I guess you'd have to say.
Incidentally, from New Zealand.
Sorry?
He was born in New Zealand, incidentally.
So really?
Not even true British. Huh?
Exactly. Like all good British people, he's not born there.
hey. Fuck you.
Famous are famous Brits. Like, half their fucking cricket team aren't from there. None of their soccer players are born in England. Richard Curtis is a very... I think sometimes, I mean, a lot of the times, in my opinion, his scripts have been directed is very very schmaltzy. Like, a film like Love Actually or Notting Hill, they came across as a little bit too saccharine for me.
Yeah.
And Four Weddings and a Funeral got the balance right. But this is a film that I feel like, again, with a very talented director in Danny Boyle, they've got the balance exactly right between comedy, romance, and I guess what one might call, you know, spectacle. And it's a really fun little what-if story. Like, I think we've all probably done it at some point in time in our imagination, gone, hang on, what if?
Yeah.
What if I went back in time and I remembered all the lyrics and music to Nevermind? And I recorded it 2 years before Nirvana did, right? You know, quite aside from the fact I can't play a note and I can't sing. That would be a struggle. That would be a struggle. But I think we've all had that little fantasy and a hint about, what if we could do that? And I think this is one of those real great little wish fulfillment films where you go, well, this is maybe what it would look like with somebody who can actually sing and play guitar, who remembers most of the Beatles songs in some way, shape, or form, and here's his journey. And it's a wonderful little film. It's certainly not a film like Joker where you would go, I need to see it at the cinema and I need to see it twice. I need to have a discussion circle in the foyer afterwards. Use of Joker as a Christ figure, you know, like
The Last Temptation of Joker.
I would see that film. But you know, like this is not that film. This is probably, I guess, the British version of a date film, but I loved it. It's so charming. Lily James is one of my favorite actresses going around. For those of you who don't know who Lily James is, I'm pretty sure she was in the last, Edgar Wright film. Which was it called again? Bloody hell.
Baby Driver.
That's it. She played the waitress who he falls in love with. And I think she was in Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, if I'm not mistaken. She's gorgeous. Someone actually took me to see that film and I hated it, but I feel like she was one of a few highlights in a very forgettable movie. It's really charming. She's wonderful. She's gorgeous. She's charming. Himesh Patel is funny and entertaining. And charming again. The script's incredible. The music's great. The jokes are great. Ed Sheeran has a wonderful little cameo as himself. At one point, he convinces the main character to change the lyrics from Hey Jude to Hey Dude. Kate McKinnon has a wonderful little role as an American record producer. His parents, who are on a TV show, a British TV show called, it was like, I can't remember, they remade it in Australia as Greeks on the Roof, but I can't remember what it was called in British. It was the Kumars at number 42.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And it's a hilarious little scene where he's trying to play him Let It Be or something, and they're just not listening and they're not paying attention. But personally, spoilers here, guys, my favorite joke in the movie is when he wakes up and he realizes that nobody can remember the Beatles. He jumps on Google and he's Googling the Beatles, and all that comes up are pictures of actual Beatles. he quickly searches the Rolling Stones, and the Rolling Stones still exists. He's like, oh, phew, the Rolling Stones still exist. And so, spoilers here, people, don't listen to the next gag. The next thing he Googles is Oasis, and they don't exist. And he goes, oh, well, that makes sense. So, like, I'm sorry, I'm spoiling one of the best jokes in the film, but that's the kind of quality material, and there are other jokes that good in the film. So, if and personally, this gets a 10 on the Shay safety scale. I think not only will Shay enjoy this, I think she will love this. Mm-hmm. I think you'll enjoy this. I gotta go on a limb. Going in a limb. There's no twist for you to spoil in this film.
No, it's not that. It's the fact that this is heavily reliant on Beatles.
I know. And it's still, I think it's a fun movie. And I think Danny Boyle's, even if you're not a massive Beatles fan, I think you'll get over it because of the performances. you don't need to be a massive, but the music's there, bro. All you need to know is, you know, it's famous.
Yeah. Okay.
And in contrast to that, I would like to contrast that with a film that I would like to advise you to stay as far away from as humanly possible, because I feel like you've earned it.
Thank you.
The dead don't die. The dead don't die. Bill Murray, Adam Driver zombie movie. This film blows.
How so?
Terrible. So, it's like Jim Jarmusch has discovered Romero films recently and gone, oh, they're pretty good. I'm going to make one of them. and it's I guess part of it is sort of an homage to Romero. He's called all his famous mates and gone, I'm going to make a zombie movie. Come and make a zombie movie with me. And so it's like an art house zombie movie, and it doesn't work, right? So it's really self-referential. Like, there's one point in the film where Bill Murray and Adam Driver are in a car, and there is a song called The Dead Don't Die. It's actually a song. And it's playing in the car. And he's like, why are we listening to this song? And then Adam Driver looks at him and goes, it's because it's the theme title. Well, it's the theme song. That's why. And I'm like, okay, you're breaking the fourth wall in a zombie movie. That's interesting. I know, like, they kind of did that in Zombieland, but it did it in a fun way.
Yeah.
But it's not fun here. It doesn't make any sense, and they don't really refer back to it at any point.
Yeah.
Characters are just, I mean, I don't know. Are you a Jarmusch fan?
Just looking back at his stuff, I've not actually seen too much of his stuff. I saw Broken Flowers, Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, Dead Man. That's it.
It's really, I guess it's, I don't know. I guess if you're a fan of his films, I haven't seen a whole lot of his work myself, but it's a very dry sense of humor at play here. And I guess if you enjoy that in Jarmusch films, you may still enjoy this, but it just sort of meanders along with, it's a story we've seen a lot of times, you know, small town, zombie apocalypse, zombies rise up, people die. Doesn't do anything particularly interesting or original with that. The characters aren't particularly interesting or original, apart from the fact they're famous.
Yeah.
And you constantly have that through, oh, that's Adam Driver. Oh, it's Bill Murray. Oh, that's Tom Waits. Oh, that's Tilda Swinton. Oh, that's Iggy Pop. That's that chick who was dating Justin Bieber. Selena Gomez.
He's not the kind of guy that I think, oh, yeah, zombie movie. Okay, cool, cool.
This is his first film to ever get a wide release, like an actual widest possible release ever. So
that doesn't surprise me.
His films are fairly niche most of the time. And I kind of thought, well, this could be fun. I guess I mean, an art house zombie film could be cool. It's got some of my favorite actors in it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they're essentially just playing themselves, except for Tilda Swinton. I don't know if she's actually Scottish, is she? But she's got a hell of an accent on her in this film.
Maybe.
Anyway. yeah, so it's just hard to put my finger out and go, it doesn't do anything you particularly want from a zombie film. It's not funny. It's not scary. It's not gory. It's not particularly entertaining. It's not particularly original. It's not particularly innovative or inventive. It's just kind of ripping off Romero films, and it's playing it off as this, hey, I'm doing an homage when I'm actually doing a ripoff. And then the end just kind of happens, and you're like, right. And all of that was for what exactly? It's a very
strange me to blow a big budget on. If you don't understand that, you don't understand the true meaning of zombies.
I don't know if it had a massive budget on this one, but probably bigger than he has. But you look at that cast list, you have Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tom Waits, Chloe Savini, Steve Buscemi, Danny Glover, RZA, who was in the Wu-Tang Clan, and as I said, Tilda Swinton's in there as well, Selena Gomez. If Iggy Pop plays a zombie, it's just, you go, wow, that's kind of cool. How can this not work? But it doesn't. It doesn't work. I guess if you're bloody-minded or a particular fan of Jarmusch, maybe you might want to check it out. But very few things on the plane helped me sleep. This was one.
Yeah. When I saw the trailers, they were kind of like putting in the trailer the most impressive zombie movie cast of all time or something along those lines. It's like, yeah, I can see that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good zombie movie. And you know, I'm not really seeing too much here. The trailer to me kind of looked like an odd variation of Three Billboards with slight zombie tones and Bill Murray comedy. Okay. Sure. But yeah, to answer the question, Tilda Swinton, she lives in Scotland and she was from London originally. Yeah. Well, there you go. Oh. Lost Travis's audio.
Is that better? There we go.
There we go. Yeah.
So most Scottish people will probably find our access insulting, man, because it's probably not real.
It depends on where in Scotland. Because she lives in Scotland. It doesn't say how long she's lived in Scotland. And considering Tilda Swinton is just androgynous in every conceivable way, no one knows truly what sexuality she is. She can play all sexualities. And
she's played an Asian man.
She could get away with it instead of Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, or Emma Stone.
Oh yeah, Aloha.
That was unfortunate. Yeah. So I guess that's my sticking the boots into Jarmusch's film, but yeah, disappointing. Could have been good. I like a good zombie film, but that wasn't it.
I feel like it's been a long time since we've had a good zombie movie, which.
Everybody here feels everyone needs to show themselves in light of what's good. I need to know myself. Thank you. die.